please, and take care.
Jack and Bob.
There it is.
Who's first? Jack?
Over the last several months, the commission has expressed a great deal of interest in this animal that has plagued Virginia's commercial oyster fishery so much. And at last month, we promised that we would provide you with a briefing. We have Bob Fisher from VIMS, who is with us today, as well as Shirley Estes, the executive director of the Marine Products Board. And I think both of them will give you a good briefing as to the current work that's being done to develop markets for this animal.
Okay.
Bob?
Bob, are you first? And then Shirley, we're glad to have you with us.
I am Bob Fisher with the Virginia Sea Grant, the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. And if you're laughing at this slide, this has been around for many years now. And it is a good example of some of the sarcasm and things that go around, have been gone around in the past, concerning the cow-nose ray and pretty much its relationship with the shellfish in the bay. I'm here today just to give you a brief overview of things that we at VIMS have done in the past and what we currently are involved with in the present time, working with the cow-nose ray resource. Just a brief introduction here. The cow-nose rays are a migratory species. They come from South American waters. They travel up through the Atlantic seaboard. And by May, early May, maybe a little bit earlier this year, since our water conditions are such, they enter the bay in large schools. They tend to migrate at both sexes together in large herds or schools. And once they enter the bay, they start separating. And this is a social aspect that we're trying to get more information out of with this current research. But it is the main thought that the females separate from the males. The females go to the western part of the bay there, as you see, and pup. They are live-bearing animals versus skate. And the differentiation between skate and ray has posed many problems in the past and currently with our marketing attempt. So what everyone, please understand, there is a big difference between the skate and a ray. A skate has its own market. It's a valued market. The ray does not have a market at this point. But as they enter the bay, the females go and they pup, and then they make their way up in the northern part of the bay. By midsummer, they're up more north near the Potomac area, and by October, early October, they're on the eastern shore side of the bay, and they are migrating out. So when they come in, the females pup. They feed extensively on shellfish, marine worms, and there's also indications from fishermen that they're starting to feed and diet on finfish caught in a different type of gear. So when they're in residence in the bay in the summer, they mate again, and they exit with embryos in place in the female. Back in 1989-90 is when we first did our first project here, research into the utilization of this resource. And we used to have the beaver, the plane, at VIMS, where we did aerial surveys and type work at VIMS. And we utilized it to try to locate and try to get an indication of the rays, how they traveled and things like that. And you can see them in the bound net there, at the head there. But they do migrate in large schools. And when they get into areas where there is food, like clams, oysters, things like that, they feed by mining. They use their mouth parts. They're not teeth. They're plates. Their wing action unearth any type of submerged benthic worms, clams, oysters, things like that. So they do have a they're problematic to our SAV as well. They uproot the submerged aquatic vegetation if it is anywhere near where their food resource is. As illustrated here on this slide, research attempts at VIMS through our Virginia Sea Grant program back in 1990 through 2005. I came here in 87, and ever since I came to Virginia in 87, we were hearing problems, and every third to fourth year, the shellfish industry members would meet with legislators, and we would convene a meeting at VIMS talking, what are we going to do about the ray issue as far as its relationship to the shellfish and the SAV problems. And every year or every meeting we would have, we would draft subwork groups where we would identify ourselves and with the task of looking at the harvesting issue, the marketing issue, and the biological issues and things involved with this resource. But in an outline there, we had Working Watermen's Association. We had various entities, both commercial fishing industries, Sapatahena. We went through the pet food industry, giving them samples for use in their products. We tried to exhaust as many potential market possibilities as possible. Funded research, again, was in 1991 project that I'll outline here shortly. We also had a fishery resource grant the first year or the second year that they were initiated. We had one for a portable anchor trap net, and that's with Dougie Jenkins, and he's in the audience today too. And there was other projects that we proposed but were not funded in 1999 and 2000 with the full utilization of the ray, using the liver for oil, used in the cartilage for medicinal use, and using the rest of the body mass that was not marketable for human consumption for liquid fertilizer. That was a proposal I submitted to the state and federal level, and it was denied funding at that point. And I mention that because it's a political situation. Back then, oyster restoration efforts and other things were not in place, and the need to study this animal was not warranted at that point. The one study, initial study that I was involved with here at VIMS, submitted the findings at the Tropical Subtropical Fisheries Technology Conference in America down in Raleigh, and it was strictly product development, cow nose ray. My graduate work was out in California at Humboldt Bay. And Hilton Oyster, Coast Oyster, had problems with the bat ray, which is a very similar species to our cow nose ray feeding on the oysters. So I had some background on this issue of predation on valuable shellfish and user groups. But during that study, we simply worked in relationship and cooperation with the hull seiners and pound net fishermen out of Guinea area in Gloucester, where we paid them to harvest the rays for us fresh. We met them at the docks, and we utilized Cook Seafood Processing Plant as a setup process pilot plant. And as you see, some of the cuts we made, we took the ray and we did several different cuts for wing tips for those type of markets, and then we cut through the wings as shown to get different products, being fillets and steak cuts. Processing that we did to get the usable product for human consumption. The cow nose ray is an elasmobranch. It's a shark species family, so it has a certain amount of blood to it and amount of urea content in it. So what we did to make it more palatable or the best possibility for success in the market for human consumption, I ran it through a series of brine washes of using 4% sodium chloride to help leach the blood out and also try to minimize the potential of urea content being a problem off over after storage. So what we did is we cut the rays up, as you see, on bandsaws. We put them through a skinning machine, a tabletop, to get skinless products. And we cut on the far right product into steak forms because this is a beef-like texture, very similar. So we wanted to see if the steak product would be usable. We took this product. We took it at Hampton Bay Days back in 91. We cooked it on a grill for people. We handed it out as they passed by and had them evaluate it. 70-some percent of the people liked it right off the bat without knowing what it was. Back then, we changed the name for marketing purposes from Cownose Ray to Chesapeake Ray, just to make it a little bit more palatable or market-friendly. Okay? And that is still within our circles here. We also took product, I believe I gave John DeMaria, many of us know, in his market, gave him about 70, 80 pounds of steak and fillets on a Friday, and they sold out of it that weekend. I mean, people bought it. So we understood and realized that we had a valid resource that we could utilize for human consumption there. From that point on, though, from 91 until this grant in 2001, I mentioned that I had another proposal for full utilization of the Ray, because we rapidly saw that if we were targeting the human consumption, the wing meat, just utilizing the wings and leaving the core body, would only get 29 to 31% recovery of actual flesh for human consumption, meaning that there was roughly 70% of it is unusable for human consumption type waste associated with that fishery. And I'll get into that a little bit later. This fishery resource grant is administered through Virginia Sea Grant through VIMS, enabled fishermen to come with their own ideas to tackle some of the problems that they're situated with. It gave them, is everyone familiar with the fishery resource grants? If you are, okay. It puts the ingenuity and the ideas in the fishermen's hands to come up with, and we just partner with them when needed to make sure that some of the science is employed in the research. But this is Dougie Jenkins up here. What his idea was a portable anchor trap net that you could, when the rays became present on your oyster grounds, oyster clam grounds, whatever, that you could deploy this net to harvest them, round them up while they're there. It was relatively quickly deployed and could be relatively quickly brought back in. So it was a portable way instead of a fixed gear like the pound nets. From that project, my emphasis was taking the rays that we were ultimately going to catch, but we had in the budget to utilize that, and I started targeting the bait market. Back in 91, when I showed those usable products, the steaks and fillets, we proved that the human consumption, that it is a marketable product, but at that point, the economics didn't warrant any fishermen to fish it. It wasn't worth it for them. Okay, so that aspect collapsed. So we had to look at utilization of that resource in a different means. So we turned to the bait industry. And I sent this, or put this slide up here just to show you of how quickly I learned. We started cutting up the ray fresh and for baits and things. And we quickly understood that the ray is a very, very bloody animal. And it's cutting it on a bandsaw, it becomes dangerous. Everyone knows of the spine on the base of the tail. And it just created a large mess. So we started just freezing the animal, as you see in the bottom right, which allowed for very little mess when we're cleaning up, just sawdust, literally. But we took that product and different forms, bait forms. We cut it up. You see on the bottom left, we cut it in chunk form like that to fit in existing fisheries bait wells. That product on the bottom left, we shipped to Florida. We shipped it to the stone crab fishery. We shipped it to the grouper long line and the shark line fisheries. We got very positive responses back from all three of those fisheries that it worked very good. It was comparable to the pig feet that they were using back there, that they were starting to have problems getting it, the pig feet, and reasonable prices. But again, economics. They wanted it delivered at 19 to 24 cents a pound down there. And our fishermen, and we just, it wasn't feasible to do that, to harvest it, pay the harvester, and to freeze it, and to cut it, and to ship it down there for those costs. So economics is what's driven some of this research in the past. We also put it through chum grinder and provided chum out of it. and we also metered in some menhaden oil in it to be further usable. Here's just an example. I just wanted everyone to see that some of the research that we want to look at, and this gives you a good view of the whole internal anatomy, is what these animals are feeding on. From this current research that we have in place, we are planning to look at what its diet composed of, because the last studies that we have on record of looking at this, the papers came out in the early 80s, but it was actually from 75 and 76 is when the diets and things were looked at. And all of us are aware that very many things have changed in 30 years. Back then, in 75, 76, the main diet and preferred diet was the soft clams for these rays. And everyone knows that those things are pretty much gone. So we're into looking at what they are feeding on at this point to get a better handle on it. Took the ray, put it out in the one of the baits that I've been testing as an alternative bait in the conch industry, put it out there. Its catch rate was half of that of the horseshoe crab, but it and the surf clam were comparable in catch rates for the conch, but still half of that is the horseshoe crab. We ground it up different ways, tempered it out, put it through a chipper to get a different coarseness to the texture there for different product forms, and it worked very well. Last year we had, through Marine Products Board, follow-up on the Boston show, we had this group from Korea come down, seafood buyers. My Korean partner here that I've been working through with different other marketable products, his mother cooked up three different traditional Korean dishes using Kano's ray, and we presented them to this group. Overwhelmingly, they enjoyed it and saw an application for an export market. Just to conclude here, our research, current research, is what we're trying to do is to get biological information as well as some more product for marketing efforts. We're not out here just going to harvest the rays just to get them in the freezer and put them out to market, because anything has to have some management if a fishery evolves from this. So we're trying to gather biological, social information as far as how many pups actually does each female produce, carry with it, because that isn't question anymore. Do the females for sure separate and pup early in the season? We want to see the social dynamics of where they are and also what they're feeding upon. So we have some basic information in case of a management is needed for an involved fishery. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Dr. Fisher. Very well done. You've done great work over there on that. Any questions from the commission?
Yes,
Mr. Garrison?
Some of the horses, we didn't get very far when we talked about bounties last year, catching these rays and just for destruction. But what kind of legislation or dollars would it take? Some of the horsemen think that you could, when that migration starts, and I think Jack had some figures of 7 to 9 million rays coming in the bay, if you could take a series of trawlers and catch these rays, and I understand they die pretty quickly on deck, and haul them off, some way to really strike this thing a hard lick.
Yes, sir.
We're wasting time and money with oyster seed.
I agree in a context. To answer your question, part of our research last year, which we're following up on this year as well, we did get permits to trawl the animals at the entry as they enter the bay when they're supposedly still in large herds. And that is to collect biological information to see what the sex ratio is, the size, weight, and actually to get a good handle of how many pups are in that in each female. Because once they enter the bay, it becomes arbitrary. You know, you may catch a female with a pup or without a pup. You don't know if that female delivered 2, 3, or whatever. So, yes, we got from VMRC, we got special permitting to contract trawlers to do exactly that at the mouth when they're still herded up in larger larger schools or herds. I need to make a distinction, and I try to do this every time I meet with the industry. Language is very important here. We have to have a responsibility. This is a resource, and we have to utilize a resource. We cannot just go out and destroy a resource for a sole purpose just to get it out of the water. And that is what the responsibility of us at VIMS, that I'm trying to make sure that we keep that up front. That's why we need biological information to drive any type of fishery for this. So I just want to make it a point that that we have to be responsible and treat it as a marine resource.
There are ways in the animal world and control, whether it be with the VMRC or the Game Commission or others in the state, where nuisance critters can be real dangerous to a species. Mm-hmm. At some point, it would seem to me that this is a nuisance critter at this point in time, and we have controlled other nuisance critters to a certain extent, whether it be. So this is something I would like for you to look into.
Yeah, so that's we do consider it as a nuisance to a certain part of our industry or for our user group. But the point that I'm taking and that I think that we have to look at is, as an example, I think it's a point of interaction as far as the user groups being the shellfish growers. And that's what we're looking at. Bottom line is what you're referring to, I suggest. It being a nuisance to the shellfish growers and a problem with the SAV. That, I look at it as an aspect of, say there's 2 million rays out there, just arbitrarily. Okay? Those 2 million rays come and they go up the bay and they separate in small pods or whatever, about 10, 12 animals, and they get on someone's oyster grounds 1 year. The next year we come down and we harvest all but 20,000 of them, say. That same 20,000 is going to feed somewhere, so you're still going to get on people's oyster grounds and feed. What I'm trying to get at is that I think this is a resource that we need to utilize for one means or another with its added value of reducing the numbers for the potential problem of eating people's oysters and clams. It's always going to be a point of interaction, no matter if you have 10 in the bay or 1 million in the bay. If those 10 are on Ron's ground there eating the oysters, that's a problem. And it's a point of interaction.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Robbins, and then Dr. Jones, and Mr. Schick, and Mr. Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on Mr. Garrison's question and comments, I think I would just like to point out that I've been in discussions with Bob on this issue for quite a while, but I would just like to commend you, Bob, because you're working obviously very closely with industry, both on the point of interaction side as far as the oyster and shellfish industries are concerned, but also on the other side, on the product development side, and on trying to fit this also into some alternative bait research, certainly in the conch fishery. This continues to be an area of interest, and Bob is working exhaustively, really, on the marketing side, on the production side, on the shellfish side. I mean, he's really spread out on this thing, but we're working in a very focused way with everybody to try to create a solution. And
I agree with that, Rick.
So I'd like to thank you for that.
Dr. Jones?
Now, I also heard from Bob say that he was concerned about the ecosystem and how this organism fits into an ecosystem function, too. That to think that you can just destroy it and then not use it wisely is really a lack of stewardship of potential resources for Virginians. And certainly without knowledge of how this works in an ecosystem, that could not be a good approach.
Right.
Did I interpret that correctly?
Well, whenever you take something out of the bay or an ecosystem, it's going to have an effect one way or another. That's why management things are in check to make sure that they're properly handled. And being a resource that has six, you know, whatever estimates that are appropriate, we don't know as far as the biomass of the rays from year to year. But if it is 6 to 7 million, I mean, that's something that can be managed as far as the fishery in my aspect.
All right, Mr. Schick, and then Ms. Holland.
Yeah, it's just good to see that multi-species management is, you know, part of the solution as opposed to just a side issue, because, you know, these things do affect other things than just the negative impact too. And have you looked at pursuing that grant as far as, again, to use the whole ray, the one that was turned down?
Yes, I'm in the process of refining it, and because of the political situation and the thing, it is more appropriate at this time. And that's something that we're hoping that this year's effort will give us a lot more biological information to go with, so we can adequately expand some of these markets and have more energy behind us to go to these markets. Because as you're going to see from Shirley's presentation, or asking her directly, this is a tough nut to crack. It literally is. Past efforts with marketing the cow nose ray have been futile for a lot of reasons. But one of the main one is trying to penetrate a skate market. Okay, the skate is a valued, marketable flesh fish. And in the past, people would talk about, yeah, we have this skate, and they'd send them the skate, and it's actually the ray, which is a bloody, meat-like, beef-like consistency product. They're two different animals, and so that's very detrimental in the past for our marketing attempts. So now we're trying to educate the people, as well as we're establishing a new market, not trying to penetrate an existing market. And whenever you try to initiate, you know, a startup market, there's a lot of energy has to go into it.
Now, as far as an incentive, you know, as opposed to a bounty, maybe once we do find a market, it's something that maybe the federal government might get involved with to kind of supplement the industry until it can, you know, take off.
Right, and that's what a lot of the watermen have suggested to me personally. I don't know how that would all come about. I'm just trying to do this first step of this, is trying to get markets developed and trying to get a good estimation on the population by gathering some basic biology.
All right, Ms. Holland.
I congratulate you on all the work. I had no idea this much had gone in, but it looks like to me you have a human consumption market. You have a bait market. It's just not, the economics aren't there to do it. What's the spread? In other words, what would you have to have, a pound for bait and a pound for what you can do to make it work?
Well, we don't know those exact numbers now, because we're trying to compare, we're trying to get that price structure. Like Korean, they have a limited ray market, but it's still, when you look at their import export things, it's ray skate. So they pay $2 a pound, say, for skate, but that's not what they're going to pay for ray. So we have to establish a market and a price associated with each one of those markets. To see where the bottom line is going to be drawn. It is favorable, that's why we need to. We did this work with the bait. We understood that we got these rays. We paid the fishermen 15 cents a pound or whatever to bring them in. We hooked up these bandsaws. We cut these things into chunks. We put them up in frozen storage. We distribute them. So there's all these costs associated. We get the product down there, and they say yes, but we're getting pig feed for, you know, 18 cents, so we'll pay 19 to 23 cents. And so for bait, that's the price that we have to look at is reality for us, anywhere between, for all these industries, somewhere 20 to 25%. That's why we've got to look harder at adding value to the ray. And the only way you can really add value to the ray is for human consumption, where it is a usable and desired, there's a demand for that product. And you'll see from our example, Chef Maxwell outside here has been effortlessly taking the product to Toronto on our behalf, to Richmond, to other culinary events, and demonstrating its versatility and its use. So hopefully we can derive a domestic market, which will help set pricing structures. But that's where we're at now. We're trying to identify those price structures.
Thank you, Bob. I think that's a good question to bring Shirley in.
Yes.
into the picture on the marketing. Shirley Estes, Director of Marine Products Board.
There. I think a ray of hope is a very good descriptive phrase, and I didn't know whether I should finish it with a question mark or an exclamation point at the end. But many of the questions that you have raised have been interesting ones on the marketing side. But we think there is a ray of hope in finding a market for the Chesapeake Ray. And it started probably 2 years ago when we were rethinking it. The Foreign Agricultural Services provided federal funds for Marine Products Board to attend a trade show in Seoul, Korea. And we were there because we knew the Koreans ate croaker, and we have a lot of them, so we were going to be selling croaker. Well, at that show, I saw a huge display of different kinds of skates and rays. And I asked the American Embassy, oh, do you eat ray here? And they said, oh, absolutely, we eat ray here. And so that's how we started with the idea that we could market cow nose ray into Korea. And so this last year I was over for Thanksgiving for an annual trade show that they have there. And the American Embassy set up a meeting with me with six of the major importers who sell skate and ray in the Korean market. The South Korean imports about $18 million worth of frozen ray annually. And their top suppliers, interesting enough, are Argentina, Brazil, Vietnam, and the United States. And when you look at those statistics, that shows you who we're competing with. We are going to have to compete price-wise with Argentina, Brazil. There's some quality differences in the Vietnam ray, so they're not as interested in that. And then the United States, it turns out, those animals are coming in from Alaska, Washington State, and Oregon. And there is a 20% duty on ray going into Korea and a 30% duty on skate going into Korea. So while the statistics suggest that the United States is providing skate, or ray rather, we think that's actually skate that's ray that's going in there, or skate that's going in there under the duty of ray. Because it saved 10%. So if that's clear, that's what we think is going on. There's no hard evidence to that, but since Washington and Oregon and Alaska does not produce any ray, it's got to be. And they are catching it as a bycatch also. 95% of all the ray that is sold as frozen wings. So that's very good for our market. Size-wise, they want between 2.5 to 4.4 pounds is an average size. So, you know, right then we're still in the market. We can do that. We can do ray wings that size. The problem comes in the price that they pay. Delivered, the average price that they are paying is $1 a pound delivered to Seoul. And so already for a wing market, you're ending up with a lower-valued product. We took this product to the Busan International Seafood Show, and it is the largest seafood show in Korea. We displayed it. Chef Maxwell prepared it very similar to the samples that you have outside to try, and we had great market acceptance. You can see everyone there eating it, talking about it, quoting. It was a very good product. They liked the product in Korea. Ray Korean style is served several different ways. 95% of it go into restaurant markets. And every block in Korea is a little restaurant, family-owned business. You know, the average dinner price is probably $6 a ticket. And they are selling rei as an ingredient to a prepared noodle dish. And it's, you know, just like we have Subway and McDonald's, they have these little noodle restaurants where they're putting rei in the noodle dish. It can either be hot or it can be cold. And the rei buyers told me they don't care if it's cartilage in there. They chop it up, they cook it, they throw it on that, and, you know, you spit out the cartilage. We don't do that in America, but I thought their rei was not as good as ours. It was not as tender. It was a little bit tough and chewy, but I didn't get any cartilage. But anyway, it was a good dish. It was a good dish. And traditionally, those products that you see are rei marinated in this red hot chili paste sauce. If you've ever been to a Korean restaurant, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And those little packets, it looked like they're about a pound, were 5,000 won, which is, you know, probably $5.05 or something like that. And then the person here was just selling them outside on the street in front of the trade show hall. So you understand it is a popular item in Korea. The Great American Seafood Festival was hosted at Chosun Beach Hotel. And again, everything I'm talking about has been federally funded. There's been no state money. There's been no Virginia Marine Products Board money involved in this. We had a two-week promotion featuring Virginia seafood and Chef Maxwell at the Chosun Beach Hotel in Busan. And the key ingredient to that would be the Jack Daniels marinating the rei. But Chef Maxwell prepared that, and for 2 weeks it was on the menu at the hotel. And then the American Embassy hosted 11 major Korean buyers for Thanksgiving. So while you guys were eating turkey, John and I were eating Chesapeake rei for Thanksgiving. But everyone loved it. I mean, the community there of non-Koreans liked it as well as the Koreans who came there for Thanksgiving. So anyway, we know that there is a market, and of course, when I said, is there a ray of hope? Well, it's a pricing issue. Then, because it was so good in Korea and Chef Maxwell prepared it so well, we started thinking more about, well, is there a domestic market? And we think yes. I mean, because of what Bob Fisher has told you earlier, because what you'll taste today, we think the Americans would eat it. It is a food service market here, I still believe, because even though that looked pretty good on the retail case, it does bleed. So if you can imagine walking into your local Farm Fresh and you see tuna and you see something that's kind of bloody on the ice, it's not going to be an easy sell. But chefs are used to that. They get that all the time in the kitchen. So if it's, you know, a little bloody, they have to skin it, they have to fillet it. They're used to that. It's not a big deal. So when we're talking about developing a domestic market, the first step would be food service, and that's where all the trends began anyway. So that would be natural. Chef Maxwell has worked with chefs. He has worked with his culinary students. Everybody likes it. I mean, everybody likes it. We think it looks like veal with freckles. You can look at it, and you'll get to taste it and see if you think that, too. And he did a presentation recently for the American Culinary Federation in Toronto, and you can talk to him, too, as you walk around and try it to get an idea of the feedback. But it has all been positive. And because it is a new product in the domestic market, we could perhaps price it differently. Because it is new, there's not a perception in people's mind that it should be a certain price. While the Koreans are locked in to a dollar a pound, the chefs may not be as locked in. And when we were talking earlier about total utilization, the way we could see that market falling is the wings could go to Korea in, say, for the dollar pound market. And then what we're now calling the loin, which is the larger cut, could go into the domestic food service market with high-end chefs. and we'd like to test that this summer with the new batch of ray that'll be coming in to see if that's a good marketing approach for that. But we think it is. Then the final market is just something that we happened upon, and it is the leather market. In Korea, the stingray leather market, and I don't know, would you like to pass around my purse here? The stingray leather market is really big. And I don't
have any money in it.
There's no money in it whatsoever, but it costs a lot of money. The leather market for stingray is very big. Please feel free to open it and look at it. It's very big in Korea, and if you go online, you will see countless examples of, like, oceanleathers.com. You'll see examples of products from $150 for a man's wallet to a couple of $1,000 for a good pair of stingray boots. It's a very high-end market, popular everywhere in Korea, Thailand, but, you know, a growing popularity in the United States as a very high-end item. If you look at my slides here, that's the way, that's my purse, that's the way the leather actually looks after it's been processed, and this is the animal that it came from. So not terribly different looking from our cow nose ray, and it is dyed to get that color and get that design, but that's very traditional, the design. So what we have found out in coming back and looking at that market is most of it is processed in Thailand. Anecdotally, we know that the meat of the stingray is discarded, and they just use the ray for the high-end leather. It is a process that they go through to get it from the brown to look like that. And so we are working with a tanner who does specialty leathers. And it's, as we said, Bob Fisher's been working really hard with these animals, but he has had some skinned by a taxidermist, and we are now sending this skin to a person who's going to tan it like it's traditionally tanned, most likely in Thailand, and then send it back to us and give us a report, you know, could that be another market? So I think what we're looking at is, yes, there are rays of hope. What we would be facing this year would be a test market to see who our market is, what products they want from that animal, how to price it, as Mr. Holland, I think, suggested, is it economical? Could we use the body for bait? Could we use the wing for one market? And could we use those loins for another market and have the whole process work economically for our industry? So that would be where we are now is, we've got to test it, and it's not a quick fix because we can't get a processor to agree to produce hundreds of thousands of pounds when you don't know if a market exists. None of you business people would vote for that. And yet you can't develop a market until you get some product. So that's why I say we're in the test phase of this market. Any questions?
Any questions? The commission? Well, I guess what you're looking at, you have a market to, like, your bait market is 20-some cents a pound. So if you narrow that down and you're going to test your market for your skin, and then if you're going to go into production with X number of rays over a two-year, then you need a grant to do a demonstration project, and that, to me, that's the way you're going to have to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then in those 2 years, you should be able to come out of whether this thing is going to economically work or not.
That's how General Foods would do it.
Any more questions?
Any other questions?
Perfect.
And we do have it prepared when you guys get a break and outside for you to taste.
Right.
You use the word quick fix and rays of hope. As I tried to bring up a while ago, there are other animals that we've had quick fixes on. Less than 50 years ago, we had very few deer in Virginia and fewer turkeys. In less than 40 years, we have more deer and turkeys in Virginia than we've had since Pocahontas and John Smith were here. And other animals have been quick fixes.
Well, we have more.
So I still think we need to look in the long run, if this thing gets out of hand, and hopefully Bob will know, of treating this ray perhaps on a market basis as well as a predator. Thank you.